Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that is a fan both of fantasy and frenzy, often both at once. That said, sometimes the trappings of the films we see tend to overshadow their very shortcomings. And that certainly was the case of the two films the three of us saw last week. The first was Top Gun Maverick, the sequel to the 1986 Tom Cruise jet jockey vehicle Top Gun. The second was Downton Abbey, A New Era, the second film version of the long-running PBS miniseries Downton Abbey, and perhaps the introduction of even more films to come. Let's begin this week's show by strapping on our flight suits and feeling the need for speed. It's been 36 years since Pete Maverick Mitchell, played by Tom Cruise, first rode his Kawasaki onto the tarmac at the Navy's elite Top Gun fighter training school. And now he has returned, with director Joseph Kosinski taking over for the late Tony Scott. And the results are attracting positive, even ecstatic reviews from critics all over. There's some good reason for that, movies in this post-pandemic era seemingly coming back bigger and louder than ever. And yes, the flying scenes, especially if you see them in as large a screen format as you can, are impressive. That fact, though, can't cover up both the script's weaknesses, featuring plot contrivances that border on absurdity, and the long stretches in which the film strains to evoke a sense both of romance and drama, despite the best efforts of Cruise, Jennifer Connelly, Miles Teller, John Hamm, and, oh so briefly, Val Kilmer. Yes, Top Gun Maverick is a worthy sequel to its predecessor, but honestly, that's not really saying much.
I was going to say, I think the most absurd thing about Top Gun Maverick is that part of the film is set in this beachside bar run by Jennifer Connelly, and all of the like 20-something Top Gun students hang out there and just play like classic rock from the 70s on the jukebox, and they know all the words to Great Balls of Fire, which Miles Teller plays on piano, just like Anthony Edwards did in the original one. So that bordered on absurdity a little bit, because I think those kids, if they were nostalgic for any music,
they'd be doing
like
hip-hop, yeah,
or something.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so that's kind of silly. But I was also sort of puzzled as to why this movie, Top Gun Maverick, has been getting such great reviews, because for most of its running time, it's a pretty standard legacy sequel. And we've gotten a lot of these over the last few years. I mean, it's been, what, 35, 36 years since the original Top Gun. And we get all of the kind of nods to the original, the visual allusions to things that have become iconic since the original one was, I think, the highest grossing film of 1986 and is seen as, you know, a major Navy recruiting film as well. And of course, the main conflict here is also built on the original Top Gun, because Miles Teller plays the son of Anthony Edwards' character Goose, who of course died in the original Top Gun. And he has these resentments towards Tom Cruise because of the death of his father, because he feels like Maverick is somehow responsible for that. So that's
it's a little bit more than that, because he felt like he stunted his career. And yeah, it becomes really complicated.
Yeah, it's true. There is more going on there. And so it hits all of the beats that you expect. It even has, you know, the romance from the first one, but with Connelly this time instead of Kelly McGillis again. And then we get to the last, I don't know, 25, 30 minutes, which I thought were really exciting and well done. There's this mission that is seemingly impossible that they have to undertake.
Seemingly ridiculous.
Yeah, that involves this underground uranium mine that they have to blow up. And it's inside of this like concaved mountain, and they only have 2 minutes to get in and get out, and they have to fly under the radar. And the movie's really smart in showing us the details of that mission, and then we get to watch them play out the training over and over and over again. So by the time we get to the actual mission, we totally understand how it works. And so that makes it all the more exciting. And of course, I'm sure you've seen the promotional materials about Top Gun Maverick that are about, you know, oh, we really flew the planes and they were really in, you know, G-force and all of that stuff. So the flying scenes, as in the original Top Gun, the flying scenes are excellent. Pretty much everything else is very corny, very predictable. It's good to see, you know, Tom Cruise as Maverick again. And I have to say that you mentioned Val Kilmer has a cameo coming back as the Iceman. And I wasn't sure.
I know. I was almost fearful.
I wasn't sure what the state of Kilmer's health was going to be. And I thought back to that really terrible police thriller movie, The Snowman, from a few years ago that had Val Kilmer in it before it had been public knowledge that he was having health problems. And that movie, it was embarrassing. Like, they embarrassed Val Kilmer. They kind of left him out to dry. This movie, I think, treats Val Kilmer with a lot of respect. And I actually thought that that one scene cameo he had was really good and let him have some dignity in bringing this part back. So I liked seeing that too. But again, that's yet another familiar plot beat that we expect from a decades later sequel, which this very much is.
So this was supposed to be released at an earlier point. Or the,
yeah,
the
like
option
2 years
was,
ago,
right.
I think. Yeah.
And then they decided to hold off Maverick. Top Gun, whatever, the sequel, the legacy, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they held off and waited to release it on the big screen. And that was certainly a wise decision mm-hmm. because this is something that you definitely need to see on the big screen. And I would suggest IMAX or Dolby, honestly, because the fight sequence or the fighting sequences and the training sequences just really demand that sort of panoramic vista. And I don't know what to say because on the one hand, it was a nostalgia thing. And I think maybe at this point in our lives, we're waiting for big blockbusters to come out. But maybe we don't want anything too weird and creepy, like some of the things that we review. And so I think that this probably fit into the right time period with the sort of right potential audience of 20-somethings, baby boomers, et cetera. And so, I mean, I thought it was entertaining. Was it a good movie? I don't know.
No. No, it's not. It's not a good movie. I mean, you know, I was trying to explain in my intro. The movie, for the most part, as Nathan was pointing out, there's many, many sequences of nothing. And it's supposed character development, and it's paced glacially. I mean, it's so slow. And it's like, can we get back to the planes? That's why we came to see this movie. I mean, they did a really good job, the Navy and the producers.
Well, let's be clear. Your dad was a naval aviator, so you might have a little bit of a bias
here.
He
wasn't a jet pilot, but he was a naval aviator, right? And so that's the problem I have with some of the believability. I mean, Maverick, I'm sorry, would have been kicked out of the Navy years before any of this.
And how many
he had
times,
his protector.
How many times has he called in front of the superior officer, played by John Hamm, to say, you need to get your act together, Maverick?
Yeah,
it happens three times.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know that would have happened over the course of his career. But talking about those jet scenes, they put cameras in these two-seaters, and so we have all our actors in back, and so they turn it on, so as a naval pilot takes them through, it looks like they're actually flying. And I got to tell you, that is the one reason to see this movie. We all agree on that. Everything else is just, I'm sorry, it's just too ridiculous. I mean, we have satellites now that would have spotted that underground thing, and we would have shot a huge rocket down there and blown it all up. And who are the enemy here? We don't know who the enemy is. Oh, they're all – are they Iranians? Or are they Chinese? No, I doubt it. Are they Russians? Are they Chechens?
When we finally see them at the end, their helmets are so dark that we can't tell who's underneath them. Yeah, that was an interesting choice. It feels like they did that just because they didn't want to, you know, maybe
call
out
anyone.
Well, I guess I'll defend. I'll defend the new Top Gun because I think that
and I'll
you
be
know,
the mediator.
even though I mean, let's think back to the original Top Gun. It has exactly the same appeal that this one does, which is that it was an old-fashioned buddy war movie with romance thrown in. I mean, all of the archetypes from those old World War II movies are present in the original Top Gun. It's a very sturdy, old-fashioned story, and they're doing the same thing here. I think the element that works here, maybe better in terms of plot than in the original one, is that dynamic between Tom Cruise and Miles Teller, who, again, they're not playing the greatest characters that either of them have ever played. But I think that tension is an interesting one. And the fact that the Miles Teller character, whose name is Rooster in, sort of a tribute to Goose, never quite comes around to fully accepting him until the very end, which again, we know if you can't map out what is going to happen as far as
problems.
That the mission with the uranium is concerned and what Maverick's role is going to be, I don't know what to tell you.
The problem is it's 2022. It's not 1986 anymore. And I hate to have to point that out. And things have changed. Now, the movie changes a little bit because, you know, the Jennifer Connelly character.
The cast is much more diverse. Yeah,
the cast is much more diverse. And, well, maybe not much more, but it is more diverse. And the Jennifer Connelly character is a fully formed character, you know, in her own right, an independent woman. So all those things are great. But I'm sorry, this whole jet jockey, you know, mantra.
You don't think that exists anymore?
Maybe it does, but it's 2022 and our expectations should be different.
Well, you know? I just want to give a shout out to the cast because I thought these people who they dragged into this film. So we knew Miles Teller. Glenn Powell as Hangman. I thought he acquitted himself nicely.
Always plays the Val Kilmer type in these
kinds of exactly.
movies. Correct,
yeah. Exactly. So, you know, I, again.
Let's not forget Monica Barbaro, who plays Phoenix, the one woman who
Lewis Pullman is in there, too.
Right. Yeah. Danny Ramirez. You know, I mean, so I liked the cast. So just if you can turn off your brain a little bit, Webster, and just go.
Yeah. And you get to hear Kenny Loggins' Danger Zone. Yeah. As the jets are landing on,
after for about 37 seconds, you do. You know, I mean, that was the entire.
I could have used a little more Giorgio Moroder. How about that?
Giorgio Moroder. Yeah, well, I could have used a lot of things for a Top Gun Maverick. That was our discussion of Top Gun Maverick. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts in Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Downton Abbey, A New Era. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Subscribe to your favorite public radio programs when you become a Spokane Public Radio sustainer, just like any news or entertainment service you use. But unlike those other services, you decide how much you want to pay. Set up an electronic funds transfer, and monthly installments will be withdrawn automatically from your account. Plus, you can start or stop your subscription anytime you want. As a sustainer, you help make your public radio station strong. You support your favorite programs, and you never have to wonder when to renew. You're part of the community that sustains public radio. Call 509-328-5729 during business hours or go online to SpokanePublicRadio.org. Click the red donate button and start the process. Working together, we make our community a better place to work, play, and listen.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Top Gun Maverick. Let's now move to Downton Abbey, A New Era. Julian Fellowes created the series Downton Abbey for Britain's ITV back in 2010, and it began showing up on PBS at the beginning of 2011. And for all of six seasons, viewers were obsessed with the Crawley family and the various characters who lived in, around, and worked at the estate of Downton Abbey between the years 1912 and 1926. 4 years after the series finale, Fellowes wrote a movie screenplay, which was directed by Michael Engler, and picked up where the series left off. And now we have yet another Fellowes-written movie, this one directed by Simon Curtis, which involves news that the Dowager Countess of Grantham, played by Maggie Smith, has inherited a villa in the south of France. While half the family goes to check out the property, the other half stays at home, which becomes the site of a film production. Those familiar with the series will no doubt be able to fill in the movie's backstory, while those not familiar can just sit back and enjoy the social posturing, period costumes, posh accents, and overt melodrama. Whatever. It's obvious that yet another film is coming, if enough viewers flock to this one.
And I hope that they have the good sense to make the next one in Tuscany, because that's one of my primary complaints about Downton Abbey.
Or most movies. Why aren't they in Tuscany?
Right, exactly. Yeah, really. Because, you know, the British people like to go to Tuscany. So I think, and as a matter of fact, they have to fill in, oh, we're going to the south of France. That's not a popular destination during the summer, but now it's going to be. So they have to provide this whole backstory, even for the location of the villa. So is this a good movie? No. Is this a nostalgia movie, much like we talked about with Top Gun Maverick? Downton Abbey fans will appreciate it for sure. I want to focus on one thing because I am going to wait to see what each of you has to say. This really is not only sort of homage to the series, the television series, it's also an homage to the change in movies and movie making and cinema, or kinema, as Lord Grantham continues to call it throughout, because they do have a character played by Hugh Dancy who is running this film production at Downton Abbey, mainly because it's falling apart, which apparently the location of the TV show was similarly situated, which might be why they were willing to have the TV show take place there. The building was falling apart. So I think that there are all these little nuggets of film history and what was happening throughout this movie that I appreciated. I don't know if you have no familiarity with Downton Abbey, and maybe we'll get some insight on that, whether this would have worked in any way, because you are just thrust into the middle of this happening. It begins with the wedding. You have no idea who these people are, or many people wouldn't know who they are. There are all these backstories to these different characters and these relationships and so forth. And if you were not familiar with the television show at all, I can't imagine that you would be appreciative of what's happening here. Having said that, I watched the first few seasons and then I skipped a couple of seasons and picked up at the very end. And surprisingly, with the exception of one plot point, I was able to pick it up. So it's sort of like a soap opera, and I think everyone can appreciate that.
Sort of like?
Well, soap operas can be good. Let's say that. I don't even know what I'm doing here because I've never seen a second of Downton Abbey in my life. And maybe I'll kind of give a little insight into how the sausage is made here, because when we were deciding what movies to do on the show, Mary Pat suggested Downton Abbey, and I said, I've never seen a second of Downton Abbey. And she said, well, it'd be kind of funny then if you reviewed it. So that's why we're here. I had no idea who any of these people are. I was able to figure it out, though. I mean, this isn't rocket science. This isn't like passing the Top Gun course. I was able to figure out, okay, so they're married. That's her son.
Yeah, there are a lot of hookups in this.
She's dying.
Film, right?
He's falling in love with him, and she's falling in love with that guy, but she's married. Like, I was able to figure all that out. The thing that I was most interested in that at least piqued my interest about Downton Abbey, A New Era, was this glimpse into the film industry of the time, because I'm inherently fascinated by that stuff. And I mean, this is basically, Dan, you mentioned this off mic, but this is basically kind of a takeoff on Singin' in the Rain, because they're making this movie called The Gambler that is positioned as a silent film. And then halfway through production, which this actually did happen to real movies. There's a Hitchcock film this happened to. Halfway through production, they had to stop everything and go, talkies are now taking off. Everyone saw The Jazz Singer and now movies have to speak. And so they have to transition this into a talking picture all of a sudden. And the star of the film, the character that's based off of, I'm not even sure who it's based off of, but reminded me of Gene Hagen in Singin' in the Rain.
Right.
She has this kind of Cockney accent that's just not going to fly in the movies. And so I think, is it Lady Mary has to dub her voice on set? So that stuff's kind of fun, although I was sitting there thinking, none of this can be period accurate, right? Like, do you really think that this group of filmmakers is going to come to Downton Abbey and be just thrilled that all the random people living there are going to stand around and watch production? And they're like, hey, you can even help out. That would never happen.
Yeah.
And also, would they record audio live in a giant echoey library filled with people? That doesn't make any sense.
You sound so much like I did in the first half of the show when we were talking about Top Gun Maverick. I mean,
but you cannot hold these kinds of things.
Yeah,
but I don't understand the nuances that might exist between the relationships and the show, so I'm looking for something.
Exactly.
And the stuff that interested me, I was like, I don't know how real this is.
Well, you know.
But whatever,
I
don't know.
The thing about Downton Abbey, I've only seen a few of them, so people who know the show will be moved by the performance of Maggie Smith and what
she has the best one-liners.
Genesis of her story, and particularly her relationship with the actress played by Penelope Wilton, because they were at each other's throat for all throughout the series.
Although
and
it does kind of seem like Maggie Smith came in for maybe like 2 days of shooting, because she disappears for a long period.
I'm sure she probably did, but as with the actual series herself, whenever she came on, she owned the screen.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so my problem with Downton Abbey, besides the obvious stuff that both of you have mentioned, is much like the series, at least that I saw, it looks like it's edited in a blender. It's like no scene lasts more than 37 seconds, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it just moves.
Well, it's like a season of television that's been condensed into 2 hours.
Precisely. Yeah. And that always bothers me, because you never get a chance really to feel an emotion in any particular scene. And in fact, the only time I ever felt any emotion was the moment that the Earl of Grantham, played by Hugh Bonneville, who was
great.
A marvelous actor.
Yeah.
You know, he starts crying, and that touched me. But that was really pretty much the only time. And that was in the throwaway scene. if you really want to see these kinds of comedies of manners, then go back and look at the old PBS series Upstairs, Downstairs, or the Foresight Saga, or Robert Altman's Gosford Park,
which Julian Fellowes wrote.
Exactly. I mean, all those are all basically the same
kind
of thing.
And Maggie Smith is in.
Yes. Yeah. You see the upstairs, you see the downstairs, you see the, you know, the idle rich, you know, the nobility, and you see the working class. Those are all much better.
But I think that this is
representation.
But this is a little bit later than that. And I think that, you know, we're still in the like late 1920 era or
27 or 28,
right.
I think.
We start to see the breakdown of some of these class distinctions that have been so important, you know, in British society up to that point, because we do see the conflation of the upstairs and downstairs people in terms of their lives coming together and so forth. And so I think that it was keeping up with the times. It was bringing it forward in a way that I think true Downton Abbey fans will either love or maybe dislike.
Yeah, and I guess maybe my insight into this, having never watched a second of the show or even the first movie, is maybe a little valuable, because I'm sure some people are going to be seeing this and walking in totally uninitiated. And so I would say that I don't know if this far into the series continuity or this the continuity of this universe, it really makes sense to start here, because there's a lot of stuff that you'll be missing.
Well, you could go back and watch those other seasons.
Six seasons.
I'm also not going to do that, because this just isn't my favorite kind of milieu anyway. I mean, I guess I'm interested in class differences, but this – yeah, it's just not really my thing. But
okay, the costumes were amazing.
The show, the TV show, the movie, the cast is great, all of that. But I agree with you, something like Gosford Park, I think, is so much more pointed, so much more thoughtful about the way this is done. And this whole thing is structured. It's like metronomic. It's like they're at a party. Then the next scene, it's two characters in a room talking and settling something that I believe was probably set up seasons ago. Then it's, they're at the villa. They're having another party. And then two characters in a room again. And it's just kind of back and forth.
It's for fans. Fans of the miniseries.
And I'm not one. So I was left out in the cold. But I'm glad you had a good time. Maybe next time they will go to Tuscany if the producers are out there listening. It's a $1 million idea.
And that was our discussion of Downton Abbey, A New Era. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I dismissed Top Gun Maverick.
Hey, wait a minute.
Let's take this moment to not dismiss, but thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from author Lloyd Alexander. Fantasy is hardly an escape from reality. It's a way of understanding it. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.